I had never had a dismembered headless torso to investigate. You know, I've investigated my fair share of shootings, homicides, a whole array of investigations, thousands, but I never had one of these. So I knew it was going to be interesting. I had no idea of what I was fixing to step into. If I had of, I'm not so sure I would have stepped in so willingly.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 58 for the week of February 9th, 2015. I am irresistible Wegmans hoagie, David T. Cole.
Oh, you in for something.
And I'm with flat-chested deaf-mute Sarah D. Bunting. Junior Detective Tara Ariano.
Senior Detective.
And Annie Billboard Eve Beatty.
I'm not interested in talking about canning.
Well, that's too goddamn bad. Hello, everyone. We are joined this week by a first-time EHG guest, Eve Beatty, who also is doing a marathon diary of The Wire for us at previously.tv. Welcome.
Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be talking about HBO's The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. But first, we would like to remind you that the phrase that doesn't pay is still in play. So keep an ear out for that and maybe get yourself an extra credit.
No, this is week three.
No, it can't be just
three. This is week
three. No.
Yes.
I don't believe it. I can't believe it.
I know. I remember specifically when it was first in play for reasons that I will not say. But yes, this is the third time.
Neat.
All right. The Jinx.
Anyway, back to murders.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much you guys knew about this guy and this case before watching this. Had you heard anything about him? Were you familiar with this?
Nope, not me.
Michigas?
I feel like... Go ahead, Eve.
Sorry. I feel like there was... Well, we might be getting ready to say the same thing. I feel like
Jinx.
I read in a library... Library copy of the of Vanity Fair, like in the 80s, like when I was like in middle or high school, about initial alleged homicide. Doesn't that seem like a Vanity Fair story? One of those things where it's like 50 pages up front and then you go to the jump and it's like 50 more pages and it's about rich people from New York.
That's so
I feel
so
like I knew about the initial story.
That you said Vanity Fair because I said the same thing to Sarah on Skype I Am last week after we had just watched it. I think I did too, but I feel like it might have been, if I'm remembering it right, it might have been later. I have a distinct memory of reading it like in an airport. But it's hard to know for sure without checking, which I didn't, because Vanity Fair only has like a story about a rich murderer like every other issue. So it's
Yeah, I looked and I couldn't find anything either. But I really, it seems so Vanity Fair-ish.
Yeah, maybe just because
the story does exist. Ned Zeman wrote it.
Oh, okay.
And Vanity Fair Confidential revisited the story. That's their new TV show on Investigation Discovery. But they did not have the cooperation of Durst, unlike The Jinx, which is such a crazy story. It sort of reminds me of like Fatal Vision and Jeffrey McDonald really thinking that Joe McGinnis was like the guy to take his side and tell his story and tell everyone how innocent he is, and didn't so much work out like that. And we don't know how The Jinx is going to end up thinking about Robert Durst, but it's pretty funny that he watched a fictional movie sort of based on the disappearance of his wife or his first wife, and then called up the filmmaker and was like, so want to have a little chatsky?
Yeah. Has anyone seen that movie? I have not
seen that movie.
I tried to watch it. I gave it about 15. I mean, cause Gosling, but really it was so boring. You guys, it was so boring. And like Gosling was doing that like accent. It was, yeah. But okay. But I have a theory about the movie and stuff. Looking at Andrew, is it Jarecki?
I think so.
So looking at his CV, which is pretty limited, this is the only fictional thing he's ever done.
Yeah.
Unless you count
Catfish.
His job as an EP on Catfish. Thank you. that got so exciting. But is it possible that this is a long con, that he made this movie, the sympathetic play, hoping that... Because he even said that that was his goal, was to create something that Durst would see and have an emotional reaction to. I just, after looking at that guy's goatee, I would not put it past him.
Yeah. He's got a weird face,
the CV
right?
is so... It's Capturing the Freedmans. Yeah. It's Catfish the movie.
Felicity. He
wrote music for Felicity.
What? Yeah.
And then this, like, yeah, that is a long and weird con. Like, it, right?
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that the fictional film was the long con.
Yeah. I thought it was weird when he did say that. Like, that's not the goal of the movie you should be making. You know, it's like, I'm going to, thanks, investors. I really want to impress this psychopath. Thanks.
Yeah, but Sarah, you brought that up in your new show fact sheet on the series, which is like, it's already kind of compromised just by the fact of it and the how it came about, both because, you know, he did make All Good Things, the fictional version of the story, and now is like, yeah, totally, let's collabo. In a way, that kind of phone call.
I agree with you. There's something about, I don't think I expressed it well in the new show fact sheet, but it's like, it, you know, and this is opening up a whole other avenue of discussion, which we don't have to walk down, about whether documentaries can ever be objective, quote unquote, or should be. I don't think they can or should be. Yeah. But anyway, his phone call with Duris, where he's sort of like, yeah, I totally agree that I, you know, wouldn't have an agenda, and you want to talk to somebody who doesn't have preconceived notions, and I'm the guy. And it's like, okay, this is how you get people to cooperate with your project. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, Durst is not a moron and must have sensed a certain amount of gold being blown up the old culo. So yes. I'm not sure that I trust Jarecki's stance, not knowing what it is, if that makes any sense. But it's still like a fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally fascinating so far. I'm totally into it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of objectivity, though, I assume that Sarah and Eve are going to say yes, and Dave will say, I know Dave will say no, but have you guys watched The Staircase?
Yes.
No. No.
Eve, you haven't? Oh, my God. You have to watch it. It's so good. It's a similar kind of thing about where it's a documentary series about a guy. Oh,
thanks for explaining that one.
Okay, sorry. About a guy who is accused of killing.
Get the
his,
electric company over here.
All right. About a guy who's accused of killing his wife.
Shut up, Dave.
Sorry.
God, yeah. Dave.
Speaking of spousal homicide.
Your mom's a docu series.
God damn, Cole. How many ways are there for me to say, shut the fuck up?
Dave.
Carry on.
May I?
Staircase. Walking up that staircase of discussion.
It's another short-term show about a guy who's accused of murdering his wife, except it's actually filming like during the run-up to his prosecution. Like, the guy has been arraigned. His name is Michael Peterson, right, Sarah?
Correct.
Oh, I've seen
They're
this.
All same named this. Michael Peterson, I feel like. But
yeah, they are. There's like three different and isn't there allegedly like two series? Killy.
Yeah, well, there's the original series that was filmed like around the time of the first trial, and then last year, or possibly in 2013, there was an additional two episode like coda, because new evidence came out, I guess. But but that filmmaker is way less like, you never see him. He doesn't get a voiceover. Like, there's no narration, and I agree with you, Sarah, that objectivity is probably not possible. But that gets about as close as you can. Under the circumstances, I feel like in just being not part of the story and just filming exactly what goes down in the order that goes down, which a lot does. Eve, you would really like this show, I think.
Yeah, you really would. And I believe the first episode at least is on YouTube. I don't know where else it's available to watch legally,
but I'm capable of investigation of that.
I rented the DVDs from Netflix, but I don't think it's streaming, but the DVDs are available for sure.
Okay.
Anyway, back to the Jinx. So how many episodes did you guys... We got the first two on screeners. Did you guys watch them both?
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
The second one is way better than the first, I think. It really gets into it a lot. That's the episode where we find out a lot more about like the actual timeline of Kathy's disappearance, Robert Durst's first wife. And, you know, I feel like the story it tells is pretty damning. What did you think?
Well, I think it's interesting that, like, the first episode is a lot of table setting. Like, here's what happened, and here's, you know, this crime in Galveston where they, like, that's what they reel you in with, which is fine. And then the second one is, like, the second crime, which actually happened first, which is, like, equally Occam's razor-y in that, like, there's kind of no other explanation for what happened.
Unless you're Detective Pendant Neck, who is completely taken in by everything Robert Durst tells him at the time.
Yeah, what the heck? But yeah, and then the then you're really seeing Robert Durst and like why definitely like friends of the wife are like, this guy definitely did it. Because, you know, as the interviews unfold, he's like, well, yeah, you know, I just made up an alibi to get them off my back. Mm-hmm. So they'd believe me was basically his argument about, oh no, like I didn't go to the neighbor's house. I didn't make that phone call. I wasn't walking the dog. I don't have a dog. I don't speak any English. What?
Yeah.
And then he's like, yeah, I slapped her. Okay. Like, he doesn't seem to have any concept of how this comes off.
Yeah.
But it definitely deepens some of the stuff that we heard in the first episode about like his brother giving a deposition about how he needed protection from his brother. Like, what and why is that exactly? So, yeah. I mean, I think it's really well built, both episodes together in terms of like sucking you right in with this, you know, headless torso mm-hmm. story. And then he's, you know, posing as a deaf, mute, flat-chested lady, allegedly.
And why in Galveston?
And then he's a super rich guy. And then he had this other, you know, he had a wife who disappeared. And then the current wife, I believe they're still married. The current wife, Deborah, mm-hmm. who is also like a really lack of affect, impatient, thinks she's smarter than everyone, weirdo, just like him. How long have you been married? She's like, I'm not sure. I think we got married last year. Like, what?
Yeah.
Is that how people are with anniversaries? That's interesting.
Eve, you were saying?
Well, I mean, I feel like it's significant to note, too, that, you know, does this count as a spoiler if it's real life? If it does, then it's
I'll
a spoiler.
Spoil tag but, it. Let's do it.
Okay. All right.
Jinx / real life tragedy spoiler. Ahoy.
So we have another, there's another homicide in between Galveston and his wife's death too. There's Susan Berman, who I assume we're going to get to at some point, this journalist who was dealing with him, and that we have, you know, that we've been able to fill two episodes and we haven't even gotten to this other murder yet. It's just like, how are they going to be able to pack it all into six episodes? I'm now wondering. That's the spoiler. Sorry, Susan Berman.
Everybody's dying left and right. Yeah. Oh, I hope you weren't spoiled for the whole case.
Well, the only
that's
reason
interesting.
I say
I had
that,
no idea.
Yeah.
Well, I said because I was watching this with my husband, who was paying attention. It's not like he was like, you know, playing Candy Crush or something. Right. And I said, you know, well, he's obviously free now. This is in the middle of the second episode, and he's like, no spoilers. And I'm like, he's sitting there in a sweater. But.
he's in a hotel suite. He's not in jail. So
the same style suite that Oprah interviewed Lance Armstrong in, I will point out, and Dr. Phil talked to Dina Lohan in. It's like that's the way you interview disgraced people now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's also I have a true crime blog called The Blotter, and I made a bingo card of like standard shots that you will see in true crime shows, including the super tight close up on the alleged killer, so mm-hmm. you can't see the jailhouse. Scrubs and you can't tell what actually ended up happening.
Right.
And at like minute 42, they'll pan out once they get to that part. And it's like, oh, he's in the orange pajamas. Got it.
Speaking of super tight close-ups, is it just me or does Robert Durst not have eyelashes?
Oh God, those blinks. What does he have?
And it seems like his eyes are like, his pupils are bigger than the average person's pupil too. Like he's hard to look at. And it's weird because when they show the archival footage of him and Kathy, especially at first, I was like, oh, they're really in love. Like, some of them, they really look happy. He
that
never should have given up
that
store in Vermont and gone to work for his dad, you guys. That was the beginning of the end for him.
That was a weirdly touching moment where he's like, I just want to have a health food store in Vermont. But the flip side of that is he's on the lam and he's shaving. And he's got something like $50,000 in his trunk of his car. And he's got a wallet full of money. And he decides to steal a delicious hoagie from Wegmans Deli.
First of all,
I mean, I know they're good.
They are really good. The reference in our intro is one time when I was in college, a friend of mine, we lived just north of the border above Buffalo in St. Catharines, and we drove over for the day, a friend of mine and I, to go shopping.
Something we call locally
going over the river because you go over the Niagara River to Buffalo or Niagara Falls. And we went to Wegmans because he loved the sandwiches there, and he went and ordered it. And they have like a bar and they make them fresh and stuff. And so when the guy was making it, at the end of it, he handed it to my friend Chris and said, "Oh, you in for something. You in for something good." It's true. He was in for something good, you guys. Wegman sandwiches are, bar none, the best grocery store. Better than Subway, for sure.
And get some cold cuts a day.
Yeah. Icky Woods.
Icky Woods.
That's right.
So, right now.
So, Sarah, you called it in your post one of the classic dumb criminal mistakes, but was it a mistake? Because the voice, whoever the narrator was at that point, whoever was the arresting officer, described it as like he wanted to get caught. But I don't think it was that he wanted to get caught or that he was dumb. I guess it is dumb because he thought he could get away with it because he'd gotten away with everything else, and then he was mistaken. But I don't think it was an oversight. I think it was just cockiness.
Well, law enforcement, at least the kind of law enforcement who are interviewed for programs of this type, are fond of saying that a lot of criminals catch themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's true because just most people aren't that smart and they'll fuck up and get caught. I think Durst is probably pretty bright, but I don't think this was one of those like cry for help.
No.
Please catch me before I kill another sandwich or whatever. I think he just is one of those people who has been really rich and insulated from the way other people have to interact with the world forever and doesn't get it. We've talked about this in terms of like the Girls Bike Club and like, mm-hmm. when do famous people stop being able to remember what it was like to just be a person?
Mm-hmm.
And he never knew, which I think is between the interview and the hoagie thing,
yeah.
I think is clear. It's like how, or like the old saw about how rich people never carry cash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or that moment in The Queen of Versailles, which I assume you've also seen, where she's renting a car from Hertz and then she's like, okay, sounds good. And when will he meet my driver? Because she's so rich, she thinks that the rental car comes with one.
All right. So anyway. Speaking of bingo, let's just run down, you know, since we have so many true crime fans here on the podcast, all these success ingredients, right? So we got,
for the series,
we got crazy dude. Yeah,
for sure.
He's rich.
Oh yeah.
He's got a demanding family, right? That's one of the things he's got. Mm-hmm. He's got
demanding,
he's got
slash
parent
maybe
issues.
Demented from what we've heard about his dad in episode two.
Right. Mm-hmm. Beautiful wives slash women, I guess.
Well, one beautiful wife, well, okay. And one wife.
Right.
Mom threw herself off the roof.
Right.
And I mean, dad made him watch. That was the craziest part of that story. I was like, back up. Why did the dad make him go look? I had her standing on the roof. That was the craziest thing to me.
Yeah. Should we spoiler this, actually? It's from episode two, yes?
Yes. And Dave, and I knew...
Jinx, spoiler two, spoilers, ahoy, fun ahoy, mm-hmm. and also spoilers, workmen are in our backyard. You're going to be hearing some hammering.
Okay, go ahead, Eve, sorry.
Well, when they're talking about Durst's mom's suicide, they show a newspaper article. And so, of course, I paused it to read it. And it actually, it's not just how he described it. Oh, mom's on the roof and she waved at me and it was no big deal. Like, there were multiple firefighters there with ladders. There were people trying to talk her down. So it was a whole huge scene that apparently ended in her death, which ruined my theory that dad killed her and Durst was covering for him because apparently there were lots of people there. But I mean, there was like a whole to-do around like this event, which is why I think that perhaps Durst did not actually have that experience, but that he had been told about it and read about it and everything so much that he sort of manufactured that memory, like someone will be talking about shortly, as I understand it.
Yes. Later on.
Mom doesn't know how to fly, she just dropped. Now she's dead and you're sad. Now you're gonna kill me. Well, I don't have the. I gotta make it up on the fly.
No, that's true. You do. So, what are the other elements?
Well, sorry, in case you weren't here for the spoiler, you're going to hear people hammering and stuff. I don't know if I said that inside the spoiler.
I can't remember.
If you skipped it, We got work people around.
Okay.
My apologies.
So back to the bingo list. Amateur sleuths.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Yeah, that's a really good one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like a cooking club or a Joy Luck club or something like that.
They're the best Montauk ladies detective agency.
Exactly. Yes, yeah.
Westchester murder mystery.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You have his participation.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Thinking that he's going to control the story. Mm-hmm. Probably wrong.
You have defense attorney with multiple fabulous hats.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Unsolved mysteries, unsolved cases, which are the most compelling cases, always.
Glamorous
for person coming back to relive her, the one that got away in Jeanine Pirro, who's now a judge on TV, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe she's just like a legal correspondent or something, but I know I'd heard of her before and not in the context of having been a DA.
I feel like she's been on that Dr. Drew Live show.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah,
with
that's
Nancy
where I've
Grace
seen her,
and
right.
All those other bottom feeders.
She looks great. Anything else that we're forgetting?
Hilarious German landlord.
She wasn't my type. I can't do the accent, but that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a lot of elements in it. It is, I mean, I'm not a true crime, you know, person, but it was compelling. Mm-hmm. I do want to see how it ends up, and knowing what that first spoiler was is very interesting.
And we should say,
there's so much more to the story.
Apparently. We did a mini post about it this morning, but HBO has put the full episode up online. It's on YouTube to watch the first, the series premiere. So even if you don't have HBO and haven't quote borrowed unquote an HBO Go password from somebody else, you can watch the first episode and see if it's worth continuing to investigate. No pun intended.
I assume everybody here will be continuing to investigate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
yes,
way into definitely. It, especially after episode 2, which was like a great leap forward, I thought.
Yeah.
Hi, Libby.
Hi, Mom.
So it turns out that all along this has been season 8. I know, I messed up.
It's okay.
Thanks, honey. I don't know why no one corrected me.
I wasn't going to.
Just kidding. So we just finished watching season 8, episode 4 of Face Off.
Yay.
Can you describe the challenge for me, please?
This was, they chose a card, and they had to make a character out of that card. And it was individual challenge number 1.
Yes. What kind of card? It's called a playing card.
A playing card.
Yeah, like with card games.
Like, would poker have this?
Yes, poker would have this.
Okay.
And so they used the face cards to make their characters.
Okay.
And what style did the characters have to be in?
What do you mean, what style?
They had inspiration. Do you remember what the inspiration was? Do you remember the guy's name?
No.
It had to be in the same theme as Tim Burton characters.
Oh, okay.
Do you remember what Tim Burton's characters usually look like?
Something that would maybe be from Alice in Wonderland,
yeah.
Maybe?
Mm-hmm. He's kind of quirky and whimsical.
What's whimsical?
Kind of silly.
It's okay if you don't know how to explain this to a 6-year-old.
Thank you, my sweet. All right, so who was the winner this week?
Emily.
What did she do?
She did the Queen of Hearts.
Did you like her makeup?
Yes, she was my favorite. And I've been noticing every week she does fancy hairdos.
Yes, she does. She's very good with hair.
Maybe she's a hairdresser.
Maybe.
Never know.
We could probably look it up after this.
Okay.
And who was the loser this week?
Daniel.
What did he do?
He did the Queen of Diamonds because, you know, he probably lost because he doesn't really hold a stick of lipstick in his hand all the time, or one in his pocket.
Right. He said that he's never done beauty makeup before, which usually looks like lipstick and eyeshadow and stuff like that. And the other contestants have more experience with that.
Yep.
Do you remember how long he said he'd been doing makeup?
8 months.
Yeah, so that's pretty good for 8 months.
Yep. And he said on the show that that it was pretty awesome because Emily said, when you need to do eyelashes, just tell me.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty nice of her, actually.
It was nice of her. They're pretty nice to each other on this show.
Which is good, unlike Homeway Runway.
Project Runway?
Project Runway.
Yeah.
She's not allowed to watch
you're
that.
You're not there yet.
Okay, well, I guess that's fair. I'm only six.
Thanks, hon. Do you have a favorite contestant?
Yep.
Would you like to share that with me?
Yes. I like Emily a lot.
You're going for her?
Yeah.
Cool. What is your favorite card game?
I don't really play card games. I don't really know card games. What are there? What card games are there?
What about, like, have you ever played Go Fish?
Yeah, I like Go Fish.
And have you ever played Texas Hold'em?
No, but I have played Crazy Eights.
Good. Have you ever played Hearts?
What's Hearts?
Hearts.
What's Hearts?
A card game. Gin?
Huh?
Rummy?
Nope.
All right. I can't think of any other card games right now.
Poker.
Poker, yes. Texas Hold'em is a kind of poker game.
Okay.
What do you think a royal flush is?
What's a royal flush?
That's what I'm asking you. What do you think it is?
What's a flush, at least?
That's the question. If I tell you, what is a royal flush, what comes to mind?
Something that would be royal? Mm-hmm. A royal, the cape thing? Cloak thingy?
Yeah? You think that a royal flush is a cloak?
Yeah!
That's not where I thought that was going.
Me neither.
Well, thanks for speaking with me this week, Liv.
You're welcome. See you next week.
Bye, honey.
Every week we send a couple questions, and that royal flush was mine, because I really thought it was going to be something. Is it a toilet kink set on?
Better man than we are.
I also have to add, Leah texted me after she recorded this and was like, for the record, she does know what whimsical means. She just didn't want to make it extra long by trying to, she's worried about making her segments too long.
All right, it's time to go around the dial, and I was doing research for something else, and I rediscovered I think previously in this podcast, maybe in Mark 1, I did the most Canadian commercial ever.
Oh, yeah?
And it wasn't this one, but this one might actually be the most Canadian commercial ever. So let's hear it. Setting up the scene, it's winter, they're outdoors, they're at the edge of the woods, and kids are playing hockey. Sides.
Scott! Wait a minute, I got Johnny, come on!
I guess that leaves Albert.
Hey, he's your kid, brother. You take him. We're gonna get him this time.
Come on, Albert.
At Canadian Tire, we carry the best names in hockey. Bauer, Cooper, CCM, Jaffa, and Coho. But good equipment is only a beginning. How far you go depends on you.
Smash cut. Where are we? We're at some sort of big, giant stadium. What's going on, guys?
I sure wish we had a guy like Albert.
Yeah.
It. And for some reason, Albert is wearing a hockey jersey. On the back, it says Albert. because he's playing in the hockey league where everybody uses his first names on the jerseys.
Yeah, that's pretty Canadian.
Yeah, it is.
For a country that the old $5 bill or the last iteration of the $5 bill had kids playing street hockey on the back of it.
It wasn't even street hockey. It was hockey. Pond hockey. Yeah.
Pond hockey, yeah.
Yeah. Albert from Rags to Riches. Way to go. Canadian Tire. Also, the Canadian Tire is the... boy, what's the equivalent? Sort of like Pep Boys meets Target. It's a really weird kind of store. And it's also the store where they have their own currency.
Yes.
When you buy something at Canadian Tire, you get something like 5% of your receipt back in fakey Canadian Tire money.
In addition to real money. It's not like they substitute it.
Oh, yeah. So your change only comes in Canadian Tire.
So
it's
like green stamps?
Sort of. Yes. Yeah.
Like, if, you know, affinity dollars or whatever.
Anyways, this is a really well-known ad in Canada, but is also...
It ran forever.
It's also one of those things where it's like a, you know, facepalm ad. It's like, come on, Canada. Really? Like, the kid should have been drinking Labatt's Blue in the background or something just to make it perfect. All right, Eve, what do you got for us?
So, the trailer for Marvel's Daredevil dropped late last week, and so this is not anything to do with the Ben Affleck movie from whenever ago, which was terrible, and Ben Affleck was smug, and everything about it was awful. It was an awful movie. But so this is a show that Netflix is going to be running in April as part of this huge deal that it put together with Marvel, where Netflix is going to have, I think it's a 4 different Marvel shows plus I guess 3 different Marvel shows and some sort of miniseries. It has a vaguely interesting cast. Deborah Ann Woll, who you might remember, she was Jessica on True Blood. That was sort of a thankless role, but she's very pretty, and I think she did the best she could with, you know, that crap that threw at her. Charlie Cox plays the Daredevil character.
Yeah.
See, I didn't watch Boardwalk Empire because it was so boring, but I guess he was a good character.
Wait, which
so
one's
he's the
he
Irish.
Was Owen Slater.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Owen.
All right. Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know what any of that means, but that sounded like a positive.
Yeah, he was good.
So there, yeah, he has very irritating sunglasses. In the trailer, but you know, whatever. Why? He's blind, so that's the deal. But no, they're not like I don't know. These are not the sunglasses I would wear were I blind.
He can't see them.
Yeah, he could be wearing those like 2005 New Year's Eve glasses. He wouldn't know.
Oh my God, these are all jokes we made about Stevie Wonder in like middle school, right? But, you know, to me, the most interesting casting news is that Vincent D'Onofrio was playing Kingpin. Yeah. That's the character that Michael Clarke Duncan played in the movie, but Michael Clarke Duncan, you know, God rest his soul, was not the world's greatest actor. You hired him because he was huge. Yes. D'Onofrio can make, you know, is like the bright spot in a lot of crappy things.
You can insert your own joke
things.
About him being huge, I guess.
Yeah.
Well,
there is
you know
a certain
what,
Brando-y...
He looks
singularity approaching.
He's in his horizontal hold years.
In the trailer,
stealing
he looks for D'Onofrio. He looks slender though. He can just be spanked all to hell.
Sure.
But for D'Onofrio, it's early criminal.
Okay,
it's early CI, not like CI towards the end when he's all gray and unshaven. You just like just rolled out of his trailer.
It's D'Onofrio,
but also in the comics, Kingpin is like big. He's not fat, but he's just like he's a brick wall. But also, he's like very fast and agile. Like he's a big guy, but he's not like a lump of fat. So it'd be interesting to see how D'Onofrio can handle that.
I'm glad you brought up the comics, Dave, because that's one of the reasons that I'm saying that I think that there are possibilities for this to actually be decent. Because as opposed to, I'm going to stop talking about the movie because there's, you know, it's like it's a dog turd that they have to scrape off their shoe, but you know, they either will or they won't. Right. But the comic book has had some really great arcs. Frank Miller did an arc way back in the day that everyone really loved, and there was an arc in 2010 that was really terrific and really dark by Brian Michael Bendis. So, you know, there are a lot of legit, a lot of being a very loose term, but this is Netflix, a lot of legit Daredevil fans out there that I think have, you know, a certain level of expectation for the show. And I think that the other thing that makes this possibly good is that since my understanding is that with most orders of shows, Netflix doesn't expect a pilot and then, you know, tinkers, obviously they don't need to tinker with episode order like a lot of shows that we would see on network like Constantine, not that Constantine is comparable. you know, they aren't going to mess around with that sort of stuff. They make an order and then you deliver the show. Right. And that's worked out for them, I think, with, you know, Orange is the New Black, House of Cards. And even though I know you guys are not a fan, I will even classify Hemlock Grove as like relatively successful in that it's unflinchingly crazy.
I mean, not Hemlock Grove. We just haven't seen it.
Oh, I thought Sarah didn't like it. Maybe I imagined that. Mm. Anyway.
Was warned away from it, but yeah.
You're missing out if you are like werewolves and teenagers in blood. But anyway, that's beside the point. Will Marvel let Netflix or, you know, the people making this show, Drew Goddard and other Buffy and Abrams people, get that crazy? I think that's dubious, especially if you've ever read Song of Spider-Man, which if you haven't, you should. It's amazing. It's by the guy who did the book for the Spider-Man Broadway show, and it's a fascinating book for a lot of different reasons about why this show was a flop. But one of them, you know, arguably is that Marvel is incredibly controlling about their properties now, maybe because they were burned in the past by things like that terrible Spike TV show based on Blade. So I think that given how controlling Marvel – remember that? Remember, oh, God, it was so bad. Yeah. So I don't think that this show is going to be that. I don't think it's going to be Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I think if it was going to be Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they would have put it on the real TV. Right. But then again, maybe they just want to have swears. I don't know.
Well,
so,
Netflix also, like, this whole package deal that they made, it was sort of, like, pitched as Marvel's Street Team. Like, it was, it was like, a smaller, you know, setting. You know, it wasn't quite as broad as the greater, whatever they call it, Marvel Universe.
Right.
So they're smaller stories. They're more contained. And that, you know, at least they're setting expectations, you know, from the start. Whereas I think Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, being so close to, you know, the Avengers and all that kind of stuff, like everybody knew it was going to be, you know, oh, Iron Man, you just missed him kind of a show. But
he was like, just here.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what's kind of impressive about Agent Carter. Like, wow, they really got Dominic Cooper, no kidding. And Neil McDonough in the last episode, too. I was impressed.
Yeah. And I think, like, for the kind of stories Netflix can tell, it makes sense to just sort of have a smaller, you know, world to work with and not be so worried about connecting it with everything and having the burden of like, oh, you know, like, you know, Captain America didn't show up or whatever, you know, like it just makes more sense. And I think that's
or even just like, oh, somebody else has the rights for the X-Men, so we can only sort of allude to them in a funky way, and it's sort of dumb and stupid. I think that the trailer also, the show looked expensive. It didn't look just all green and hey guys, you know, so I feel like, you know, well, you know what I mean though, right? It doesn't look all tennis ball. Right. So I feel like that there is a possibility there, and D'Onofrio has made it a definite, at least I'm going to give it a shot in April.
Sarah.
Speaking of Law & Order properties, SVU, turn it around. It's gotten so much less annoying in calendar year 2015. And I'm actually not sure why that is. Benson has toned it down somewhat with the always being almost about to cry. And we hear about Noah, her foster son, but we don't see him and he's not taking up whole episodes with a subplot. Amaro, who is my least favorite character on NBC, I think, had a taking it personally episode all of his own a couple weeks ago with his dad.
And it was not bad.
Yeah, that should have been murderously annoying.
It should have been unbearable.
I should have stepped out a window, but he learned from Ice-T's stink eye. I think if you go back in the previously archives, the lead photo I used for that was him on the stand, just setting something on fire with his mind.
Yep.
And Pino, for whatever reason, like got a haircut, got a little bit of a tan, put on 10 or 15 pounds, and just generally is like being way less annoying.
Yeah, well, Armand Asante played his dad, so that may have made him step up his game effort-wise.
That's true. Plus, they paired him with Peter Scannavino last week, Sonny Carisi on the show, and it was a pretty handsome sandwich there. I'm not getting comfortable with it being, you know, a C-plus instead of a C-minus, and Benson's let me explain to do something routine with the post-rape drama is really getting old, and she's got to stop. And I've been watching a lot of old episodes recently, and despite some hair missteps, she used to be so much cooler.
She really
like,
did.
Totally forget that she was kind of rad in like seasons 2 and 3, and then it all just became whisper crying. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to not actively dread certain headlines that are getting ripped. I don't think Gamergate is going to be a particularly nuanced investigation of this particular episode this Wednesday, but
will it be worse than the second last episode? That's the question.
Oh my God. I still love that episode.
I know you do.
Love it. Vixie Platinum forever.
That one was just on the other day. I have to also give a shout out to USA, which is where I think most, if not all, of the reruns are. I guess it's sold in syndication elsewhere, but they are the best at throwing together like themed marathons. And sometimes it's just, they don't even care. It's like Angry Elliot marathons. Like that's every episode.
That's all.
But because it was the Grammys on Sunday, their theme on Saturday, which I watched, was the grannies, and it was all episodes where grandmothers get up to crazy shit, and it was amazing.
That's awesome.
It was great. Every episode, you're like, how the hell are they going to work a grandmother into this one? There was always a way, and it was awesome.
That is impressive.
I know.
For that idea to make it through all the levels of management to get to air, that whoever started that, they should get like a medal to wear around their neck as they walk around USA Studios.
I think so, too.
Amazing.
I just wanted to, first of all, since Sarah mentioned Law & Order, say in passing, there are rumors as of late last week that NBC is considering reviving Law & Order for a limited 10-episode series, which I think we all hope fucking happens, especially since the rumor is that they, well, it said original cast, which literally could mean anything.
Yeah.
But I think it would be like...
It will not mean Michael Moriarty.
I was just going to say, that's what I want. And all about abortion. Every episode about abortion.
Crime?
He's got to be too old now. Like, right? He's got to be in his 70s. No? Maybe not.
I mean, I know he's old, is the issue.
Oh, I know. But I mean, even
I think ran for prime minister of Israel from Alberta is the issue.
I know. I'm just saying that they couldn't even think
God
about
bless
it because he's got to be in his 70s.
Shine on, you crazy DA.
I know. So we'll be watching this story very closely and giving you updates as soon as it gets out of the rumor phase. But I wanted to actually talk about Jane the Virgin, which I've been writing about all this season on previously.tv. It's such a delightful show. Really, it's like a basket of Hershey Kisses every single week. It's so sweet and charming. If you don't know, the story is this girl, Jane, who is a virgin, gets artificially inseminated by accident when she goes in for a routine pelvic exam because her gyne is distracted. And then it turns out that she's been inseminated with the sperm of this guy that she had a crush on a million years ago. Anyway, things happen. All of that is beside the point because the main reason to watch the show is Rogelio, her father, played by Jaime Camille. I know it's cheap to keep writing about him every week because he will retweet it and then we get like thousands of shares on the stories. But he legitimately is the best thing about that show. He is so, so, so funny. Apparently he comes out of telenovelas for real. But his storylines are almost all comedic on the show, and he just fucking goes for it. And they have really been very judicious about how much they use him because they could overuse him. He's that funny. But it's usually just a sprinkling of him in every episode, and I adore him so much. His takes, his hair, his faces. Last week he did a vision board. Like, he's just 100% delightful. And if you haven't checked out that show, you really should. It's quite sweet. Has anyone else seen it?
Oh, I love in every subscript and superscript, every sort of type like setting thing or something, there's a great joke in it and it's not too arch. That's what I like, is that it's self-aware, but it's not posing. It's not Danger Five, you know?
Yeah. They also do really funny things where they do recaps on the fly, like they'll pause the action and then have like typing over the screen where they like say, this is so-and-so, she's so-and-so's girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. And then they have a narrator that's also very witty and arch as well. So it's great. Highly recommended. Please watch Jane the Virgin.
Okay, excuse me. It is time for the canon, and Eve has brought us something. Take it away, Eve.
Well, so today we are talking about Never Again, which is season 4, episode 13 of The X-Files, known, I guess, in maybe my social circle as Scully Gets Some, but I don't think she actually does.
I thought anyway, that too.
I know, no, it's weird, right? That's how, like Durst, I had a specific memory of Scully get, and like someone we're going to talk about in a minute, I had a specific memory of Scully getting some, but she doesn't actually. But anyway, I'm jumping ahead. The point is, this is actually, I did not realize it when I chose this episode, incredibly timely. This show first aired on February 2nd, 1997.
Oh, wow.
So if you had had a baby, which thank God none of us did, the day that that show aired, this baby could vote or get drafted today, but the show still feels very timely to me, and it's not just because I am very, very old. So we open up on this guy that I think is probably more familiar to people now. The character's name's Ed Jurst, and he's played by someone who at the time was basically just a swimmer and a model. His real name is Rodney Rowland, which for some reason seems hilarious to me. On the show, Rodney Rowland. But his character's name's Ed Jurst, so we'll stick with Jurst. His divorce was just finalized in Philadelphia court, we learn. And then he goes to a bar after his divorce is finalized. The Pretenders play in the background because that's what plays when you feel terrible about yourself. And he puts his cigarette out on his own face in a photo of him with, I assume, his kids as he's staggering out of the bar. And of course, the pouring rain, he sees some really pretty traditional flash tattoo art in the window of this tattoo joint. Then we see him back at his apartment, which looks like something straight out of the movie Seven. Mm-hmm. He removes his bandage, which you should not do for 24 hours after you get a tattoo, folks. And then
you.
He collapses on... Yeah, right? That makes me crazy.
Annoying.
And then he collapses
anyway,
on the floor.
Sorry.
Game guy, like, shrug emoticon.
Oh,
you
know.
Don't do that! So he falls on the floor, and we see that he has this, you know, pinup girl tattoo with this banner that reads, Never Again, show title, drink, in a banner beneath the tattoo. After the credits, we're in way more familiar territory. It's Mulder and Scully talking to some Russian guy about something. It doesn't matter. It's inconsequential. The point is they're near some sort of public memorial. Scully wanders off. She doesn't care about what's happening and starts picking at some left-behind roses, which means something. Then we're back with Jurst, who's now sweating the previous night in some sort of, you know, Wolf of Boiler Room kind of job. He's selling penny stocks to what we described in the 90s, perhaps as housewives. In the middle of this call, he starts hearing a woman's voice calling him a loser. He thinks it's someone in his office taunting him, so he goes apeshit, throws some stuff around, he gets sent home. But he's not the only white guy who's having problems today. Back at X-Files HQ, Mulder is stomping around because he has to take a vacation, but he's so dedicated, it's so sad. And you can tell that Scully is over it. Finally, she cracks, and that's time for our first clip.
Here's a few things for you to keep an eye on while I'm down.
Why don't I have a desk?
What do you mean? I always assumed that was your area.
Back there.
Okay, so we'll have him send down another desk, and there won't be any room to move around here, but we can put them really close together, face to face. Maybe we can play some Battleship.
God, Mulder cannot read. I know, God, he's the worst. He cannot read a room, and he keeps on scolding Scully, who I will just note in case anyone's forgotten. Scully is a graduate of medical school and law school. Mulder, I don't know what he has, like probably like a BA in porn. I mean, and somehow got a job with the FBI. But still, he's going to tell her what to do.
He's definitely an English major. That's all I'm saying. As an English major.
Oh, you know what he is? He's an MFA candidate who didn't finish. That's
who
he
you're
is.
Right.
But you know, he's you know, riding Scully. He didn't pay attention to the Russian guy. He's mansplaining to her that she has to go to Philly and do some stuff. And so then she gives him this sick burn. Just another clip.
I'm not going.
What do you mean?
Your contact, while interesting in the context of science fiction, was, at least in my memory, recounting a poorly veiled synopsis of an episode of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Eeny, meeny, chilly, beanie, the spirits are about to speak.
Rocky and Bullwinkle are looking for an obsidian mine. Boris Bodanoff alters the road signs, which causes them to walk onto a secret military base, where they are picked up by a car with no windows and no door locks, and there are silent explosions from a compound called Hushabum.
So you're refusing an assignment based on the adventures of Moose and Squirrel.
Refusing an assignment? It makes it sound like you're my superior.
Oh, that's right, Scully. He is not your superior. He is not. But anyway, you know, that's it for those guys for now. We're back with Jurst. He's working from home, those are air quotes. He's trying to make amends with work. It's not working. He's not going to get that awful-looking job back. He hears the voice again, this female voice. And, you know, if you're listening and you've recently watched Inside Man, which is on HBO all the time, you'll realize, hey, it's Jodie Foster. She's in this episode, she sounds way like she's having way more fun than she has in years. But she does kind of sound like her Inside Man character. And this is also where, as I mentioned to my colleagues on the podcast, if you decide to watch this episode again after listening to this, I urge you to watch it on headphones. I've already sounded like a huge dork, so I'm over it. But there's this really cool sound design where you feel like her voice is really swirling around in your head. It's a nice note, given that in 97, they probably weren't expecting you to watch the show on headphones, and you wouldn't have appreciated it at the time. So it's I don't know. I really appreciate, though, that they did that little thing back then, because it really works. I was watching it on the bus on the phone. I know I'm awful. I'm like that. And I was just like, ah, I actually made some noise. Everyone thought I was weird. Anyway, so Juris has decided, we're back to the show now, that his downstairs neighbor is fucking with him, trying to drive him nuts with this voice. And she's trying to get into his head. So to the strains of Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted, which is a Partridge Family song, he bursts into her apartment and he kills her. It's a legit creepy scene, because you don't actually see the violent act. You just see the follow-up, where he's lugging her body down to the building's furnace or boiler or whatever is in all the the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, where you have like that thing with a flame burning in your basement. I don't know. I don't have one in my apartment, but I live in California. You hear the voice again, and now she's praising him. And that's sort of the moment, I think, that he realizes that his tattoo is speaking to him, which takes us to our next clip.
Attaboy, lover. From now on, I'm your right-hand gal. You and me. As long as I'm with you, no one will ever hurt you. Never again.
I mean, that's awesome, right? I would totally throw a body in a fire if someone said that to me, so I get it. But despite Scully's assertion that she's not going to go to Philly, the next thing you know, there she is. She's in Philly. So despite Scully's assertion that she's not going to Philly, she's there staking out a scene in Little Russia. She's led to that same tattoo parlor that we remember from the pre-credits, where she's called to the back by the proprietor. He's conferring with Juris, who seems to think that the tattooer can somehow fix the talking tattoo. And that's our next clip.
Miss, you like this on his arm? Eddie?
The color, the red on the lips, it's extraordinary.
Something I find in Soviet prison. I tell him, everyone gets tattoo they deserve. Beautiful, cheap.
I thought I was your girl.
Tattoo reflect on body what lies in person's soul.
You'd break my heart over it.
Did you get them all done in prison?
Yes. Use the sewing needle, paper clip.
You talk to her. And leather, I'm going to be bad.
Urine. I find grasses grow in prison yard. Rye and such. Only use now on that tattoo.
Yeah, he said urine. It is what it is. Tattoos are an ugly business. But even though he's talking about urine, you can still... The chemistry that you feel between Scully and Juris, it's palpable. But that's what you might expect when you've got a smart hottie who's been cooked up with a dork like Mulder, and she's meeting a swimmer / model in a tight t-shirt. Juris, despite all his problems, asks Scully out, but she begs off. However, she has a frustrating phone call with Mulder in the following scene, where Mulder is predictably a jerk yet again. The next thing you know, Juris is sitting in his apartment in the dark, listening to his tattoos say misogynistic things, and hey, it's Scully on the phone. Now he's got a date. Just to be safe, he now puts his cigarette out on his tattoo, not a photo. So Juris's car is in the shop. So Scully has to go pick him up, where his embarrassment over his shitty apartment is eased by Scully's revelation that her social life is craparoo, as we hear in this clip.
I don't go out very much. I think the last time I went on a date was to see Glengarry Glen Ross, and the characters in the movie had a much better time.
Oh, geez, Scully, if you thought that that movie was misogynistic, just wait for the rest of your date.
She needs the good leads.
No kidding, she does. Scully decides to get really wild, and oh my God.
I'll get it.
It is, it's my landline, which never rings.
This is exciting.
Wow.
Someone stole the landline. Neat.
Oh, it's because I call prisons.
Because you taped a...
Yeah. Yeah, if you talk to prisons, you have to have a landline. Even those, like, you know, the AT&T phone won't work. Anyway, sorry about that. I just hung up on whatever criminal was just calling me.
Okay, hang up on me, will you? I'll get you in 15
minutes. There's an angry tattoo in Quentin right now.
You like as hoagies? I was,
this one's free. So Scully asks Ed to take her to the crappy bar across from the tattoo shop instead of to somewhere nice. They sit there and drink, and Scully reveals more humanity than she has in the series to date. And we've been through about 4.5 seasons. But even though the conversation is atypical of the series and the character as we know it thus far, it really feels natural. We know that Scully is a tightly wound achiever, and we get an explanation for that we haven't really received previously. We also get the impression that maybe she's just about had it. A theme that comes up several times in the episode comes up at this point. Is life an infinite circle, or should it be a straight line? Which one is better? Which one do we want? And then I think Scully thinks, fuck this philosophy shit. I'm sitting next to a swimmer / model. And then we get into this next cute little tussle on this clip.
I want to see it.
You know, Dana, just because I marked the moment, wanting to go forward doesn't mean that it worked.
I want to see
it. Come on, it's almost scabbed up.
It's okay.
If you're so curious, get your own.
I probably should have specified that this was about his tattoo. It's a sexy scene. It's sexier than it sounds, but it's nothing compared to the scene following where Scully decides to get an Ouroboros, which is that snake swallowing its tail. She gets a tramp stamp, but tramp stamps were different in 97, and she asks the tattooer, Jurs asks the tattooer to give her the tattoo in the same red that he got. This is important, you guys. The scene is really hot. I mean, and remember, back in 97, we didn't know Gillian Anderson as sort of the sexually omnivorous person in The Fall or the sexually whatever person she is in Hannibal. This was really a revelation in terms of the Gillian Anderson, who was definitely like a poster girl at that point, seeing her in that light. But even without the 90s context, I think that the scene still has legit sizzle. But despite all that sizzle, they go back to Jurs's place because it's snowy and Scully should spend the night. But even though they have this odd sort of embrace, Jurs spends the night on the couch and Scully spends the night in the bed. I don't know, you guys. That's the only moment of this episode that doesn't sit well with me or feel legit, but it's possible that I'm just sluttier than Scully. The next morning...
Well, also, she has a fresh tattoo on her butt.
Not that bad, never stopped yeah, nobody,
no
my
right
friend.
Yeah,
there's plenty of ways around that.
Really?
David, we'll tell you when you're older.
I'll discuss your weird sex swings stuff. Let's move on.
I was just thinking, keep the bandage on.
Guess I'm never working for the FBI.
So anyway, the next morning, Scully's awakened not by pain from her tattoo or anything else, but a knock at the door. And she looks flawless. Of course, she woke up like that. It's... cops investigating the disappearance of the downstairs neighbor, saying that some of the blood that was discovered at the crime scene was abnormal. As Scully discovers by doing a dial-up internet search, the abnormality is ergot toxicity, perhaps due to the red in the tattoo, which Scully remembers the tattooer saying came from use of rye. When Ed returns from grabbing breakfast, he's all smiles. She tells him about it and says they need to go to the hospital. Ed's reaction is not what Scully expected, as we hear in this next clip.
Such a relief to be able to tell someone. I hear it, Dana. In my head, only deeper. It's more than just some chemical reaction. She talks to me. She hates women. My wife, my boss, you. She's so jealous, Dana. She makes me do things I don't want to. But she controls me. But I believe that you made her go away.
What was that?
And sorry, I'm a mess. That was my dog honking something horrible. That was my dog reacting to Ed Gerst's obvious lie that no, it's not the tattoo that hates women, it's him. You know, of course, it's not that easy. The love of Dana is not going to save this crazy guy, which is one of the things that I really, really adore about this episode. Women are so frequently fed, oh, you know what? If you love this bad boy, then he's going to be all better. And that is completely not true in this episode, which I think is a preferable message. Regardless of all that, the tattoo, haha, freaks Ed out by telling him that even though Scully has not made an effort to hide that she's a Fed, the tattoo says, oh, she's been trying to hide it. It's a tattoo. Jodie Foster says all this, and he attacks Scully. And once again, it's an honestly tense and scary scene. I mean, we're educated people. We know that this is not the one where Scully dies because her name is in the credits, but it's still scary. Scully does her able best to fight him off. She's, you know, she doesn't puss out. She doesn't, or do anything, I think, especially stupid. She does the best she can, but you really realize she's so little. And he is really big. And as opposed to, you know, everything that we've seen with Buffy or whatever, when you have a really big guy and a little woman, no matter how much the woman wants to win, the big guy is always going to kick your ass. And that's what happens here, but not before she tries to fight him off with some scissors she found in the bathroom. The tattoo knows what to do with an unconscious Scully and says so in this clip.
Another woman in my bed? Turn the sheets, lover. Burn her. Burn her!
That tattoo was not nice. So now we're back down by the basement fire thing. Scully pops out of the shroud that Ed has put her in with the scissors. She's ready to fight, but so is the tattoo. And they have the following argument.
This isn't you, Ed. Go on, Eddie. Get control of yourself.
Ah, but it's good to lose control.
Take control.
Do it for me, Eddie. Do it.
And then Gerst puts his arm in the flame. It's pretty horrible, but it shuts Jodie Foster up. And then, you know, after that moment, we go straight to the inevitable sort of wrap-up splat, sort of exposition scene between Mulder and Scully. And even now, Mulder doesn't get it. There's an argument here that maybe Mulder never gets it, but that's a different conversation. Here's how the scene ends.
All this because I didn't get you a desk?
Not everything is about you, Mulder. This is my life.
And I think that that's a line that probably should have been used more in this overall series, but, you know, I'm happy to have it here. There are a lot of different reasons I believe that this episode of The X-Files is canon-worthy. I think it has strength as a standalone episode. Even if you've never seen The X-Files, I think that you could watch this and get it and enjoy it and be engaged. I think that it's strong as a turning point in Mulder and Scully's relationship. Once again, is this carried through? I don't know, but I'd like to think so. And, you know, also there is the fact that the guy who plays Ed Gerst, the former model, takes his shirt off a lot. back in 97, we weren't seeing as many ripped guys as we are now because it was harder to get HGH. So, you know, I appreciate that. I also think that, you know, even 18 years after its broadcast, I still can't believe it was 18 years, it's one of the best depictions of how women are treated. From Mulder's slights at work to Gerst's behavior at home, even though, you know, it's sickening to me that things have not changed that much with how men talk to women at work or men talk to women at home. I think that it's completely true today. But I also like that the theme that, you know, misogyny is so pervasive, it's a little less sort of obvious and Schoolhouse Rock and dude, what are we going to do? Because so much of it comes from the tattoo played by someone that we think of as a strong woman, in fact, a strong Fed. But I still think that the message comes through and the message gets there, and it's true for today as well. So in summary, if you do not vote this episode into the canon, you hate women. Thank you.
Now we're behind the eight ball. All right. Famous lady hater, Tari Oriano, you go first.
My recollection of this episode, or I should say my misrecollection was the same as yours. I remembered it as the one where Scully had sex also, and that seems clear that that does not actually occur. And I also remembered a lot less Mulder in it. I was thinking as we started, like, oh, I don't know how this is going to be, because not that I particularly care if he's in it, but it's not really a typical episode if he's completely absent. But he's in it quite a lot, and pivotal for all the reasons that you said, and a complete prick in hilarious ways. God, all the clips that you picked are so perfectly like, shut the fuck up, Mulder, you dick. He's so dismissive about her wanting a desk. Like, it's been 4 years. Get her a desk. What is your problem? Just move the stuff around. You will still have room to walk in that room if you have two desks. Give me a break. But yeah, I think this is... It's definitely different, but I think it's very important, and it's certainly on the list of like the best episodes that people remember of the show from the run of when it was at its best. So I think it's a good pick. Sarah.
I was on its side immediately because it's not an alien myth arc episode. I didn't mind those, but I generally prefer X-Files that are a little less spacey. I thought Jodie Foster was a little much. I'm not a lady hater, but I'm kind of a Jodie hater.
What do you mean?
What was that?
It was Jodie Foster. She's back.
Yeah, it was a lot. I mean, I know it's like a voice role, but she's always kind of a lot. Like Silence of the Lambs was on last night, and naturally, because it's a Poppy Fields movie, I got becalmed by it. And I mean, I don't know. I kind of just don't get it with her. It's not actively bad. I just think she's overpraised. Ditto her work in this episode. But there's just something about, like, Gillian Anderson is so great, and there's just something about her staring dully at Mulder and just repeatedly being like, "You're the worst," that I enjoyed.
Yep.
And the episode is like greater than the sum of its parts somehow. I don't know. Like, I've seen this one a bunch of times, and it was nice to revisit it. And I agree that Scully, despite wearing the next day man's shirt, that's usually the like mm-hmm. universal signifier of having gotten some. Yep. I agree that they didn't capital D do it.
One other thing I forgot to say.
She had her suit pants on even when she got out of bed. Who sleeps in suit pants? I still would have taken those pants off.
That was super weird just to sleep in, especially since, as you say, she just got a tattoo. Speaking of which, one thing I forgot to say was that scene where she's getting it as it were. And the way the camera angle is on her, like, there's a reason that everybody takes their selfies from like slightly above, and it's like she looks so good in that shot compared to how dowdy she normally looks in like those enormous coats and terrible suits that are the pants.
At least she
are
wasn't
too
wearing
short.
The white tights this time.
Yeah, seriously. But like that sagey colored sweater or whatever that she's wearing, like it's what she should be wearing all the time if she asked me, which she didn't, and she should have. Dave.
I wanted this episode to be campier, like way, way campier for the subject matter, and, you know, taking cues from Jodie Foster's voice work. I felt the whole episode would have benefited from just being crazier and campier. Like, I think that was the intent, you know, either that or they struck a weird, unsatisfying middle ground for me if it wasn't. There's something about when Scully and Mulder are apart that I can't get into with the X-Files. Like, for me, it might be a little unfair to judge this episode by all the other future Scully alone, sad lady files episodes that are to come, where she's like, well, am I a good Catholic? Let's take a season to think about it. Or, you know, sad childless Scully, you know, episodes and all that stuff. Among my least favorite episodes are the Scully solo episodes. I do like it when they're together. They work best when they're together. this episode didn't really seem very sexy to me. I thought the actor, the guy who's, what's his name again? Ronald?
Rodney Rowell. Oh,
Rodney something.
Doesn't that guy sound like he should have an RV store? Selling RVs on the highway, big billboards. Come on totally. Down to Ronnie.
Yeah.
RRRV.
Yeah. So, I mean, this episode, I would say, is fine. I don't think it was a bad episode, but I just don't think it was canon worthy. But the sound design was really interesting. As you say, the guy, the sound engineer, was giving his pan dial a real workout during the Jodie Foster voiceovers. They like quickly go left or right to left or right. It's a little disconcerting the first time you hear it on headphones, as you say, but you know, it works for that reason. I have one note, which was the fight music, which is this. I'll play a bit for it. Which is pretty atypical for the X-Files. Yeah. It's so much like this music from Pee-wee's Big Adventure's Bike Hell scene.
Oh, yeah.
Including evil laughs.
Yep.
More. Anyways, also while I'm there.
Is this something you could share with the rest of us, Amazing Larry?
No wrong time.
Yeah, no wrong time for that clip. So, yeah, I think this episode is fine, but I don't think it's great. I don't think it really doesn't really feel like an X-Files episode to me, just because, you know, they spent so much time apart and Solo Scully is not really my favorite thing about the X-Files. So I would probably say okay, but not canon worthy. But let's see what everybody else says. Tara.
Well, first of all, now we know what Dave really thinks about women. Yep. But I'm going to vote yay.
I'm against them.
I vote yay.
Sarah?
It's a very good episode. Not one of my favorite X-Files episodes. I don't think it is actually one of the greatest. So this woman hater is voting ixnay. Sorry.
All right, X-Files Season 4, Episode 13, Never Again. Sorry. By one vote, you lose out on the canon. All right, we don't have a known exhibition, but since the last with the Star Trek Nonak, where we finally decided on exactly what the parameters were for Nonak, which is it's got to be really, 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 really bad, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the very worst episode. I wanted to revisit Dawson's Creek Downtown Crossing, which was done on our all Nonak episode over the holidays.
We had our break in October, November.
Yeah. So I think it might be time for a reevaluation of this, given the new criteria, because I think generally our consensus was on that episode is that it's really hard to have the worst Dawson's Creek episode
without
in an episode
Dawson.
Without Dawson. Like, Dawson was such a terrible element of Dawson's Creek that it seemed wrong. It seemed a betrayal of the no-neck spirit.
Dawson is Dawson the no-neck of Dawson's Creek.
Exactly. Like, he is made of 99% no-neckium. So, given the new parameters, I just wanted to do a quick revo. We don't have to rehash the episode, but it's the Joey gets mugged in Boston.
And
episode.
Ends up singing to her mugger. Yeah. He dies.
Truly a terrible episode, but let's just revote on the no-neck. So given the new no-neck rules, Tara, do you think this belongs in our no-neck?
Absolutely.
And Sarah?
It's not the worst ever, but it's in the bottom three. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I also agree. So with apologies to whoever submitted that, sorry, I don't have your name in front of me. We are now rejiggering. And that is now in the no-neck, and you can visit a new dedicated no-neck page on our website. It's like the canon page, but I separated out all the no-necks, so it is now there. So I'll move that over to the win column for that one.
Americans love
music.
Yeah. And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Yeah, no music, sorry. We don't have time. We don't have an extra half hour for that to play out. Winner and
recover
loser
from laughing hysterically at it.
All right, Tara, who's our Sarah, who's our winner?
Our winner is Chicago for a bunch of reasons. Namely that Dick Wolf's Chicago Fire and Chicago PD are being joined by the following spinoffs: Chicago Med, Chicago Parking, Chicago Sanitation, Chicago Writer's Block, Chicago Coffee.
Chicago
just
CSI.
Kidding. There's actually only one of those, but Empire, I believe, also shoots there. The Good Wife technically doesn't do anything there, but is based there for some reason. Like, why didn't they just make it about New Jersey? Also corrupt.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Don't email me. So yeah, the city is having a good TV moment, unlike some people.
Sirens too shoots there.
Oh, yeah, I'm surprised to hear that Empire shoots in Chicago. That looks pretty New York-y to me.
Yes.
Anyway.
Loser of the week. Yay, Windy City.
Loser of the week, Brian Williams.
Oh,
when I put this in the doc last week, I had no idea about how much worse it was going to get. So what happened was Brian Williams, I guess in 2013, went on Letterman and told a story about being in a helicopter that came under fire. And then last week had to go on his news show and say, just kidding. Like, it seems like something happened, but it wasn't that. And then it just got worse and worse because, of course, then everything else he ever said about anything has come under question. Now they're like, he told a story about getting mugged. Did he get mugged? Did he exaggerate his Katrina reporting? And he...
Allison Williams is like, he's not even my dad. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it really calls into question everything positive he's ever said about girls. But he put himself on suspension. And
how noble of him.
I know. And he also was supposed to be on Letterman again this week, but he canceled that appearance for obvious reasons. So this seems like a really weird story. I don't know why, like, this anecdote that he told on a talk show 2 years ago is now such an issue, but whatever.
Well, and it's something that happened like 10 years ago, right?
Yes.
So now it's like, why now? It's weird. Like, the timing of it is weird. On
right,
the plus side, though,
yes,
Dateline fans, Lester Holt is taking over the chair, and I like Lester Holt.
Yes. Well, yeah, he's good. Yeah. I mean, in the annals of sketchy reporting about the Iraq War, I would say this is not in the top 5% of most egregious journalistic crimes. But anyway.
I'm sure Geraldo has done 5 things that are worse than that.
Guys, you gotta be able to trust
Judy Miller still has a job.
I was going to say, yes, exactly. Judy Miller does still have a job. Of sorts. But anyway, sad for Brian Williams. All this by way of saying, make sure your anecdotes are true before you tell them on a talk show.
Guys, you know what time it is?
Lie time?
Nope.
Oh.
Game time.
Oh. Oh.
Oh, one thing I forgot to say about that X-Files episode is Jodie Foster going, burn her, burn her. All I could think about was Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the witch scene.
Yeah.
John Cleese going crazy in the mm-hmm. foreground. All right, everybody. Game time is here. This is the sixth game time of the season. Tara, 3 points. Guess, 2 points. Sarah, 1 point. Today, Sarah Bunting, your time has come. Today, we are playing Ripped from the Headlines, a game that will challenge your knowledge of true crime on TV.
Oh.
This game comes from suggestions from EHG Assist Crew on Twitter.
Thanks,
and has
guys.
2 rounds.
Oh, my.
Ooh.
We'll explain the rules for each round as we go along. So for now, let's just throw it to the person in control choosing initiative or Picky 3000 to see who's going to start things off.
We will start with Tara.
Whoops. Oh. Well, there we go. Well, all right.
All illusion
right.
ruined.
Are we ready to play Rip from the Headlines?
So wait, what's our order? Me, then who, then who?
Oh, you, and then Eve, and then Sarah.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Are we ready to play Rip from the Headlines?
Yes.
All right. Round one. Made-for-TV true crime movies.
Oh.
I am going to describe the plot of the movie in question.
Yes.
You name me the title of the movie for 1 point and the lead actor for another. Sometimes there's more than one lead and you can just name one of them.
Okay.
If you want a hint, choose to have one of the answers read to you and guess the other. You get to choose which one you want as a hint.
Okay.
Cool.
All right. Understand?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Tara.
Yep.
Stacy had it all. Looks, rich parents, and she was the queen bee in high school. Things go south when she threatens new student Angela, who just wants to be her friend, that she's going to tell everyone at school that you're weird. No, what's the movie?
Oh.
Who's the actor there?
Stacy. I'll take the title, please.
All right. The title, Death of a Cheerleader. And there's two possible leads here you can name.
I'm just going to go out on a limb and say Tori Spelling.
Nice.
That's good for 1 point. Or Kelly Martin.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, Eve. Though she became the subject of a famous rhyme outlining the gruesome crime of murdering her parents, she was actually acquitted of the crime.
Oh, man. God's smiled on me. I assume that this is Lizzie Borden Took an Axe and Christina Ricci.
That's good for 2 points.
Soon to be a series. Miniseries.
No way!
Yeah, their Lifetime made a miniseries of it. Coming soon, I believe.
God, speaking of inappropriate music.
All right, Sarah.
Yep.
Here's your first. The story of a school teacher who had an illicit affair with one of her underage students and eventually gave birth to two of his children.
Ooh.
The movie, The Actor.
One of my favorite true crime stories.
Oh, my God.
Who was in it, though? I don't remember.
I don't remember who's in it either, and I'm certainly not going to remember the name. Oh, man.
So do you want the title as a hint? Is that what?
Sure.
Okay. Title, All-American Girl, the Mary Kay Letourneau story.
Oh, gosh.
Who played?
Letourneau.
And I'm going to give you this. Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, there's two listed. I was going to say, I thought it was two different movies, but it's the same movie, but they just listed the Mary actor in another one.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And the kid.
Really?
Who played her? Shit. Marky Post.
Feels like an Elizabeth Mitchell role, but I know it
Penelope
wasn't her.
Ann Miller.
Oh, of course! That's good casting. Yeah.
Okay, back to Tara.
Yeah.
Boulder, Colorado is stunned when a beautiful 6-year-old girl is found dead in the basement of her parents' suburban home.
Ooh. Oh, Marg Helgenberger played her mother, but I can't remember what the movie was called.
Perfect Murder, Perfect Town.
Right.
All right.
Based on the book by Mark Furman, if I'm not mistaken. Mm.
Back to Eve. This charming, handsome, and charismatic serial killer was responsible for dozens of deaths before being captured in Salt Lake City, Utah, and eventually executed in Florida.
One of the all-time greats of TV movies.
So I'm thinking the lead is Mark Harmon.
Nice.
And just the Ted Bundy story, or?
Deliberate Stranger.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. I own it.
All right, Sarah.
Yep.
And there's, by the way, everybody gets 3 questions in this round.
Okay.
So here's your second, Sarah. A pregnant mother to what? That doesn't make any sense. Okay. A pregnant mother to be vanishes on. I don't even know what that means. A pregnant mother vanishes on Xmas Eve, and her devoted husband and her family launch a massive search for her. As no real leads turn up, suspicion starts to point towards the husband, who might have not been as devoted as he once seemed.
Oh, my God. Well, it's about the Petersons, and I don't remember who played. I don't remember. Can I have the title, please?
The Perfect Husband, the Lacey Peterson Story.
You know who played the husband.
Who was that perfect husband?
It's one of two people. Rob Lowe.
Oh, shit.
Dean Cain, right?
Yep. Dean
Cain. That was my choice.
Princeton's own Dean Cain, no?
All right. Back to Tara.
Yeah.
This suburban housewife did not take kindly to the affair her doctor husband was having. Eventually, he moved out and divorced the wife, getting married to the young assistant he was carrying on with and taking custody of the children.
God damn it.
The now divorced wife became unstable, leaving hundreds of threatening messages for her ex and ignoring restraining orders before eventually murdering the ex-husband and his wife in their sleep.
This is not what I was thinking of at all. Title?
Title. 2 titles for you.
Okay.
A Woman Scorned, the Betty Broderick Story.
Oh, sure.
And part 2, Her Final Fury, Betty Broderick, the last chapter.
Meredith Baxter?
That's okay. Good for 1 point. Yeah. Sarah,
nope.
I felt you knew that one.
Yeah, Picky screwed me.
Yeah. All right, Eve. Here's your last question of this round. The wealthy heir to the Fontainebleau Hotel fortune marries a stripper, but their kinky relationship quickly turns sour when he winds up brutally murdered.
Oh, shit. Here's the thing. I did read about this in Vanity Fair, but I can't remember any of the details.
All right. Do you want a hint?
Yeah. Give me the title.
Title, Beautiful and Twisted.
Oh, that was no help at all. I give.
Rob Lowe.
That was on like last week.
Damn it!
Very recent history.
All right, our last question of this round, bringing us into our score break for Sarah. The fanatically uncompromising Len Rowan and his family insult and terrorize the citizens of a small Missouri town for years. One afternoon, Len is shot and killed on Main Street, an event that was witnessed by up to 4 dozen people. But the sheriff soon learns that nobody saw a thing.
Oh, man. I know this case, but I want to see it. Can I have the actor?
Yeah, the actor, Brian Dennehy.
Okay. I'm just going to guess, based on what the book was called, In Broad Daylight.
Nice!
Finally, she gets on board.
1 point. That ends round one. Let's hear our scores.
Sarah has 1 point. Eve and I are tied with 3 each.
Okay. Lots of game left as we head into round two. Round two's title is called Chung Chung.
Oh!
Name the true life inspiration for these Law & Order franchise episodes.
Mama!
All right. So Tara starts, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to read you some information. You got to tell me the perpetrator or sort of like, you know, what the case was named.
Yeah.
We'll grade on a curve
okay.
here. Okay.
Yep.
Some answers have more than one, but we'll play it by
okay.
ear. All right.
Yep.
Season 17, episode 16 of Law & Order Original Rays. Titled Murder Book, Green and Cassidy investigate the death of a publishing agent who approved a book written by an ex-athlete that describes how he would have murdered his wife if he was in fact the real killer.
Well, I believe this is probably about If I Did It by O.J. Simpson.
I think you are correct.
Okay, how many points? 1?
1 point.
Okay.
All right. Back to Eve. Season 4, episode 24... Perfect. This is also Law & Order Original Rays. When a girl is found dead in an alley with apparent signs of abuse, Benson and Stabler are called in to investigate. What they learn about her leads to the discovery of another girl who went missing a year ago and a cult run by a man determined to clone a human and use girls who are starving for acceptance to further this agenda.
Sidebar, this is SVU, not original.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes.
And there are two answers here. This is one of those blendos. Blendos.
Clone? You said clone a human?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I got nothing.
That was Elizabeth Smart and the Raelian Cult.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Fuck. Sarah.
Yes.
Season 10, episode 15, Fools for Love. I don't know why I'm saying a sing song. Fools for Love. Let's hear about this terrible murder. A man is accused of raping and killing his girlfriend's sister and another victim. Prosecutors make a deal with the girlfriend for her testimony against the accused, but they also suspect that she was a willing participant in the murders.
Never get back in Canada if you get this one wrong, Sarah.
I know, seriously. This is a Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. This one a couple times. Is this the one with Meredith Grey? Or
I think so.
Okay. Yeah, yep. She's fucked up and really good.
So,
at this
so creepy.
Tara?
Yep.
Season 10, episode 1, Gun Show.
Mm-hmm.
Original Rays.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Yep.
Gun Show.
Yep.
After Jack is forced to settle with a man who committed a mass murder against female medical students in Central Park, he decides to go after the gun manufacturer.
Is it the Montreal shootings?
Yeah. Okay. Montreal Massacre, Mark okay. Lapine?
Mark, yeah.
Yeah. Eve.
Female engineering students in Montreal.
Special Victims Unit, Season 16, Episode 8, Spousal Privilege. A retired professional football star is captured on surveillance video knocking out his longtime girlfriend, but the victim is reluctant to leave his side.
This is from this season, by the way.
Okay, I was like, because obviously we have a multitude of choices, but so this is, I guess, involving Ray Rice and his wife. Ray Rice? Shit, is that his name? Ray Rice?
Gonna need a final answer.
I don't know, it just seems like so many NFL guys beat the hell out of people this year. Now I'm confused about which one it is. I'm gonna say Ray Rice.
What?
Shit!
Ray Lewis, it says.
No, it's Ray Rice. That's from this season.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
Yes. We got you. Cool. We watched that one.
All right, good.
By that one, you mean the video of him beating his wife in the elevator?
I did not watch that, but I did watch Nev's the episode. Photo. Yes, and in the SVU, it all happens in an elevator, so it's Ray Ray for sure.
All right, Sarah, here you go. SVU, Season 13, Episode 1, Scorched Earth. An African immigrant working as a maid accuses an Italian diplomat of rape, but is she really just in it for the money? Meanwhile, Stabler's return remains in doubt after his latest shooting.
God. I don't remember the guy's name, but it was a French guy, and his name was Dominique.
Well, all that information is correct. I think that was pretty close.
I think that's good enough.
Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Yes, sorry.
Yes, and that whole thing. Yeah, that's fine. Like, these are tough to answer, you know, the full names and all that. So we're going to grade down the curve here. So that was good for 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
Back
Thank you.
To Tara.
Yes.
SVU.
Right.
Season 7, Episode 16, Gone. Uh-huh. A female student from Montreal goes missing during a class trip to New York City after she spends a night partying with three cocky prep school boys.
Is this Natalie Holloway? Oh boy.
It is correct. All right, number 17.
It's pretty.
Yep. Pretty cool.
SVU. This is for Eve. Season 10, Episode 6, Babes. The grisly murder of a homeless man leads detectives to four high school girls who made an unusual agreement amongst themselves. But when it gets out, somebody drives the girl's ringleader to suicide. I'll give you a hint. We're not looking for a person. We're looking for the name that the crime is known by, the case.
Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I have not seen this episode, so I'm just spitballing here, but I don't suppose this is the Slender Man homicide.
They did do that one, but more recently.
Yeah.
This is the Gloucester 18 Pregnancy Pact episode.
Oh, Pregnancy Pact.
Yeah. All right, bring us into our next score break.
Who plays the mom in that one?
Can't remember.
Debbie Mazar, I think.
Hmm.
All right, Sarah?
Yeah.
Season 1, Episode 15 and 16 of Original Rays, The Torrents of Greed, Parts 1 and Part 2. Stone makes a deal with a group of low-level mobsters when they offer to testify that a crime boss murdered a missing union leader. However, the prosecution case unravels at trial, causing all parties involved to walk. After the crime boss murder case gets thrown out, Stone turns up the heat on the witnesses who played him in order to find charges against this crime boss. In conclusion, crime boss.
Yeah, I don't... I always skip these episodes because I think they're really boring. And I'm actually not sure what they're based on. Vinny the Chin.
John Gotti.
Hey.
Yeah.
Also thought he was kind of boring.
All right, 19, Tara.
Yep.
SVU, 16th season, yep. Second episode, American Disgrace.
Mm-hmm.
A basketball legend is accused of raping multiple women, but what exact role did the powerful CEO of the sports apparel company who could I just copied this and it's very poorly worded. A basketball legend is accused of raping multiple women, but what role did the powerful CEO of the sports apparel company who had a contract with him play in the situation? And there's a few answers here. This is a super mash. This is a
melange. Yeah, it is.
This is the Berlin mix.
And I saw it, and Terry Polo was the victim, and Stacey Keach was her dad. But I...
You got so many people here that are involved. So many cases.
I know.
Just have to give me one.
Kobe Bryant. Damn it!
This is the Beyonce, Jay-Z, Ray Rice, Donald Sterling mashup.
Donald Sterling!
Right.
Ugh,
all right.
Damn it.
On to Eve. Original Rays, Season 18, Episode 18, Excalibur. While preparing a murder case, the DA's office stumbles on a potential scandal involving a prostitution business and the governor of New York. It could have serious implications on Jack McCoy's future as a district attorney.
They didn't try that hard to mask this one.
No.
So, is this Spitzer?
It is. It
Blade
is.
Himself. Just kidding.
The horrible thing is, at first I was going to be like, The Good Wife, you guys. It's based on The Good Wife.
Okay, Sarah. Yep. Trial by Jury, Season 1, Episode 6, Pattern of Conduct. Kieber? Kieber? Is that her name? I don't know.
Sure.
K-I-B-R-E.
Yeah. Anyway.
Prosecutes a basketball star accused in the rape and murder of his mistress. She has to grapple with a starstruck jury, legions of sports fans, and a wealth of media coverage. The already trying case takes a new turn when the basketball player's wife has a slip of the tongue while on stand.
Is this Kobe Bryant?
It is. Benson.
Thanks, Kobe.
Okay. Back to Tara.
Yep.
Original Rays, mm-hmm. Season 8, Episode 6, Baby It's You and Homicides.
Oh.
Season 6, Episode 5, Baby It's You.
Okay.
A teenage supermodel dies after being sexually assaulted. A dual city investigation focuses at first on an obsessive fan and later on her father before a stunning revelation closes the case.
Ooh. Murder.
Teenage supermodel dies after being sexually assaulted. Dual city investigation focuses on first on a obsessive fan.
God, I don't know. Gia? I know.
John Benet Ramsey.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay.
Huh?
Aged her up. Fair enough.
Weird.
Yep. That's a Law and Order twist.
Fair enough. Yep. Also, yep.
Darn city.
Okay. Eve. Season 1, Episode 19, The Serpent's Tooth.
Which series?
Original Rays.
Okay.
A businessman and his wife are killed. That's it. That's all I get. No, just joking. The couple's two sons emerge as the most likely suspects, but detectives later find business ties to the Russian mob. Mm. A businessman and his wife are killed. The couple's two sons emerge as the most likely suspects.
So is it the Menendezes?
It is.
Sure is.
Correct. All right, Sarah.
Yep.
Original Rays, Season 17, Episode 7, In Vino Veritas, a washed-up anti-Semitic actor is arrested with blood on his clothes. Do you want me to read the rest of it? Detectives later discover that a Jewish television producer he has connections with has been murdered. Mm. But what role, if any, did he play in it?
Michael Richards?
Oh.
Whoa.
Is it Mel Gibson?
It's Mel Gibson.
Oh.
That was a gimme. All right. If I said sugar tits or something in there, you would.
Oh, right. That's right.
Okay. So we're back to
me.
Tara?
Yep.
Here's your last question.
Okay.
SVU, Season 14, Episode 16, Funny Valentine. Can SVU convince an up-and-coming singer to break away from her abusive hip-hop singer boyfriend before it's too late? Wait.
Yes.
2 points for each of your last questions if you get both people involved.
Okay. Rihanna and Chris Brown.
That's good for 2 points. All right, Eve, here's your last question, also worth 2 points. SVU, Season 15, Episode 3, American Tragedy. A celebrity Southern chef shoots and kills a teenage African-American boy that she thought was a serial rapist. But was her life in danger, or was she just an overreactive racist? Two people, real life people involved here.
It's two cases also.
Yeah, it's a mashup. One of those mashups. What do you think?
I'm going to go with Paula Deen. And, I mean, this obviously could be about a zillion things, but Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman?
Correct.
Trayvon, yeah.
Trayvon Martin.
So, yeah. 2 points.
All right, Sarah, here's your last. SVU, Season 10, Episode 19, Selfish. An immature, irresponsible young mother is assumed to have killed her child, but it turns out to be part of a measles outbreak. ADA Cabot then goes after the mother of the child who started the outbreak, who refused to immunize him. So, two things, mashup.
So, Casey Anthony and...
And the mother who doesn't immunize anybody?
Jenny McCarthy? Really?
That's good for 2 points. Let's hear them scores.
Nice. All right. Sarah has 6 points, and Eve and I are tied with 8 each.
With what?
8 each.
8 each. All right. So that
sorry, I got too excited.
Time
eight
for
each.
Our
different strokes.
Our tiebreaker between Eve and Tara. Mm-hmm. First person to shout out the answer wins. Okay. You get one shout before the other person gets the answer. You can't answer more than once in a row.
Okay.
All right?
Yep.
Original Rays. First season, third episode.
God.
Okay. The Reaper's Helper. A gay man with AIDS is accused of murdering another gay man. However, he claims that the victim also had AIDS and that it was a mercy killing.
What?
What's the... Is this... I'm going to read it again and pay attention to everything I say.
Yep.
Season 1, Episode 3.
Yep.
The Reaper's Helper. Mm-hmm. A gay man with AIDS is accused of murdering another gay man. However, he claims that the victim also had AIDS and that it was a mercy killing. I'm kind of tempted to take this call. Sorry, I have my Mac set up to take calls from my iPhone.
All right, so it was the late 80s.
I mean, is it just Kevorkian?
Oh, of course.
What? Nice. All that gay stuff was red herring.
That's why you had to pay. You had to pay attention to the title, "The Reaper's,
Helper. Good job, Eve. Helper. Nicely done.
Miscues aplenty on this episode. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great.
We made plans to murder our spouse.
Jinx. Oh, you coke. We checked in with our six-year-old face-off correspondent before going around the dial with stops at Albert. Albert, Daredevil, Daredevil, Law and Order SVU, and Jane the Virgin. Eve unsuccessfully pitched us the tattoo episode of The X-Files Never Again for the canon, and we evaluated Dawson's Creek's terrible downtown crossing for the Nonax New Rules, and now it's in. We crowned winners and losers of the week and the guests, valued guests, thanks to Eve, win this week's Rip from the Headlines Game Time.
Well done.
Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
burn her!
Sarah T. Bunting.
Not everything is about you, Mulder.
And Eve Beatty. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Guess what?
What?
I have a surprise for you.
Yay!
Last week, you know how I told you that when you do your podcast, there are lots of people who listen to them?
Yeah.
And you have some fans? One of your fans wrote an email to Dave Cole and Tara and Sarah. Remember Sarah too?
Yeah.
And here's his note. It says, "Hey previously.tv crew, Liv Sunflower Lion from the Face Off Report was too fun an idea not to draw a quick sketch. Extra Hot Great keeps me company on long nights drawing comics, and I thought why not draw something for you guys? Thanks for the show and keep up the great work. Josh." And he drew a picture of what he thought your lion would look like. What do you think of it?
Nice.
Can you describe it for everyone?
What it is a dark brown for the lion, and then petals for the mane, and then the tail, there's leaves, and at the very end, there's a flower part.
Do you approve of his drawing? Does it look like something that you think would work for your lion flower?
Yeah, except for I didn't make the tail part. But the rest is what I made, actually.
It's like you two are on the same page. Maybe you should start drawing together. Just kidding. He probably has a job that he has to draw for. What do you say to Josh?
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Josh.